should yet let you know he's older than I am.
But I don't look it.
That's what happens when you don't clean your glasses every day. Thank you for inviting me to give this fourth talk, Lenten talk here at the cathedral. Why I've chosen this subject is because this is something that I've been working on for quite a long time now, because as well as being parish priest at St Margaret's, I have this rather grand title of the Master of the Guild of Our Lady of Ransom. Now, the Guild of Our Lady of Ransom was founded in 1887 and to support the work of evangelisation in England and Wales. Its two first members were Cardinal Manning and a fairly unknown priest at the time called Father John Henry Newman. And so the Guild has been there over the years supporting the works of evangelisation. So when I was asked to take over, when I came back from Walsingham, it became clear that much of the work that had been done, which essentially had become a grant-making trust, and I just used to sign at the end of the year grant for all the different dioceses. But it became clear that we were in a very different situation within our world today. And so we started to think about how could the Guild actually work towards helping evangelisation and helping the church at this particular moment in time. So my talk is about much of the research that we've done and some of the things that we are proposing to do. So this unique contribution, insight, is trying to help us to look at a new narrative to be able to preach the gospel today. Not a new gospel, but a new way to be able to be witnesses to it and how to speak about the importance of our faith and how that, in real terms, has been the absolute foundation of British society. So that's the background to the talk. For those of you who listened to the Today programme, there was this morning a very interesting piece. I can't remember the name of the fellow who said it, but it was about the decline in liberalism. Hello? Decline in liberalism. And the impact of this decline on the West. And this is a quote. "The decline of liberalism refers to a perceived crisis in the Western political order, marked by rising popularism, weakened institutions, and declining public trust. Critics argue that liberalism has failed due to its own success, creating elite overreach, economic inequality, and a loss of community, prompting a backlash from both the political left and the right." In April last year, I was contacted by the Guardian newspaper, and they asked could they come and interview me, because of the very high numbers we had between Easter Sunday and Sunday before to Palm Sunday. Thank you very much. We'd had about 5,000 people who had come to all the masses, so it was bigger than our norm, but it was, you know, it's a big parish. And the journalist from the Guardian turned up, and she was there about 3 hours asking all sorts of questions. And the basic premise of her interview was this: if something new is happening, you must be doing something new. If something new is happening, you must be doing something new. And I'm sitting there scratching my head thinking, I'm not sure I am doing anything new. I'm not sure. I couldn't think of anything that I was doing. And then I realised, I said, well, actually, I don't do anything new every day. But I do something ancient every day. I celebrate the Eucharist. Every day I do the same thing. Every Catholic priest does. Whatever else you might do, that's what we do. It's the primary part of our day, the celebration of the Eucharist. And this ancient was one of the reasons, the reason the Guardian was coming, because of this report from the Bible Society about the increase in church attendance among young people, particularly young men. And the statistics show that now of the churchgoers, 44% who go to church on a Sunday in this country are Roman Catholics. So we are the biggest group now. And ask any priest anywhere about, is there something happening? And they'll say, well, there's something. Yeah, there's something in the air. So the numbers of young adults coming in my parish now have gone right up. So I was a parish priest there in the 90s, and I was born and bred in Canning Town. And when I was a boy, and certainly when I was parish priest in the 90s, I'd say a third of the parishioners were, like myself, elderly. They were old people who hadn't moved out, they'd been there, they weren't going anywhere, and they were there, and their family, many of their families were still there. That was a third. The next bit would be families, and then the next young bit would be the younger one. Well, that's gone now. That's gone now. I'd say it's about 10% now who are elderly. The next biggest one will be middle-aged and older families. But the largest group now is our young adults. Our young adults. And for what reason? It's nothing I've done. I haven't got any new cunning plan that's brought dragging them in off the streets of Canning Town. But the statistics show that something is changing. Now, there's a lot of opposition to statistics. People say, well, you know, it's just statistics, you can make it up. Well, that's probably true, but there's always a certain indicator in statistics. But much more significant is not the statistics. Much more significant is the anecdotes. It's the people saying, well, you know. So we have a WhatsApp group. We've got 150 signed up in the WhatsApp group. They meet every two weeks, between 40 and 50, 30, 40 or 50. But they're always a good-sized group there. So there's something there. Something is happening. And it's not that I'm doing anything new. And that's one of our problems. It's the thing about the new. If you're doing something new, if something new is happening, you must be doing something new. So I said to her, the way you understand Catholicism, right, is not that we do something new, but that we do something ancient. And it's this ancient thing that is the foundation, because that tells us that the great description in the church, that the teaching of the church is ever ancient, ever new. That's the radical nature of Catholicism. That is the unique contribution of Catholicism to British society. That's it. So thank you very much for coming tonight. So that's it. Uniqueness is it's ever ancient, ever new. That's how radical it is. And remember, radical means going back to the roots. So you've got to have those two things. You know, nothing changes in the church. Everything changes around it. We get new popes, new bishops, new deans of the cathedral. We put new parishes. We do this, that, and the other. There's wars. There's famines. There's all sorts of things happening around it. But that which is the heart of our Catholic faith does not change. And not because it's old-fashioned, or not because it's new, but because it's ancient and new. So, one of our great theologians is called St. John Henry Newman. And he says this in his Second Spring Sermon. The Second Spring Sermon was given in 1850 at Oscott College in Birmingham for the first Synod of Westminster. So it's the first gathering of the bishops after the restoration of the hierarchy, the big event after the Reformation, the reclaim from the Reformation. He says this: "The physical world revolves year by year and begins again. But the political order of things does not renew itself, nor does it return. It continues, but it proceeds, because there's no going back. This is so well understood by men of the day that with them their progress is idolized as another name for the good, for the new. The past never returns. It is never good. If we are to escape existing ills, it will be because we are going forward. The past is out of date. The past is dead. We must find something new. We must find something new." The unique contribution that we have, the radical nature of Catholicism, is that it is ancient and new. In the Confessions of St. Augustine, he writes, "Late have I loved you, O beauty, ever ancient, ever new. Late have I loved you. For you were within me, but I was outside. And it was there that I searched for you. In my unloveliness, I plunged into the loving things that you created. You were with me, but I was not with you. Created things kept me from you. Yet if they had not been in you, they would have never been at all. You called, you shouted, and you broke through my deafness. You flashed, you shone, and you dispelled my blindness. You breathed your fragrance on me. I drew in breath, and now I pant for you. I have tasted you. Now I hunger and thirst for more. You touched me, and I burned for your peace." Beauty touches our heart, giving us a mirror of our true self. Truth sets us free, as it says in the scriptures. You shall know the truth. The truth will set you free. And goodness enables us to share with others what we ourselves have received. So this truth, this goodness, this beauty that's been at the very heart of our civilization since Roman times. Remember, the first martyr in this country was a Roman soldier, St. Alban. Right the way back, Christianity has been the foundation. In an article in the Times in December last year, the Jewish Labour peer, Lord Maurice Glassman, wrote the following: "I realised that my freedom and safety were secured by the life and the teaching of Jesus Christ, as embodied in my country by the English Church. And this was the same for Muslims, Hindus, Sikhs, and atheists. That we all found refuge in the loving arms of Jesus and the participation of all people in self-government, with our liberty and security secured. This was the sublime gift of the Church to our society. I do not believe in Jesus Christ as the Messiah, because I'm Jewish. I simply recognise that our political inheritance was shaped and formed by the Church, and that this is the greatest of our blessings. The renunciation of civic violence was central to this, and this is what is meant by the kingdom. The English Church is the glory of our nation. I now trust the Catholic Church to lead more wisely." He goes on. "Pope Francis said, we are not living through an era of change, but a change of era. His words were prophetic. And we are living through a volatile moment of transformation. The balance we strike between kindness and truth will define our engagement. That is why I believe, as a Jew and an Orthodox one, that in politics, Christ is king. That in honouring God, we honour his creation, incarnated, that the attributes God gave to himself when he spoke to Moses on Mount Zion are the very condition of good politics. Mercy, grace, kindness, and truth. That's why secular republics fall. It's not only that they yearn for a king, but they reject the very nobility that is essential for virtue. Ever ancient, ever new. That is why the restoration of the body of Christ into the body politic of our nation is a vital aspect of our revival. I give thanks to the English Church for its wisdom, its grace, its truth, and pray for its restoration. And I am grateful to the Prince of Peace who guided its way. It is a remarkable article, a truly remarkable article, an insight from someone who's, he's about as Jewish as you can get, Morris. You know, his whole life he's totally immersed in it. But he goes around Parliament saying Christ is King. And they all get a bit confused. And as he said in his article, he said, that doesn't mean, I don't believe he's the Messiah. But I do believe in this country, our head of state looks not to himself as the ultimate authority. He looks to Jesus Christ. Remember the coronation? The most Catholic event we've had in hundreds of years was that coronation. And it was all about our head of state pointing to Christ the King. This is our King. This is where our values come from. This is where Magna Carta comes from. This is where our history, our foundation comes from. So that's why the restoration of the body of Christ, which is the church, into the body politic of our nation is a vital aspect of renewal. In Magna Carta, it starts off, the king is not above the law, for Christ is king. Know that before God, it says, first article, know that before God, for the health of our soul and those of our ancestors and heirs, to the honour of God, the exaltation of the Holy Church and the better ordering of our kingdom. First, we have granted to God and by the present charter have confirmed for us and our heirs in perpetuity that the English Church shall be free and shall have its rights undiminished and its liberties unimpaired. These, we wished this to be observed, appears from the fact of our own free will. Now, that's a long time ago. Yet, it's there, part of our story, part of our history. And very often, when we come to moments in history, kind of crossroads, we say, we need a renewal. You know? And I'm not sure that the words renewal and restoration, which is another word used for it, are strong enough for what we need today. No? Talk about renewal, you know, it's like renewing the lino on the floor. You know, we're going to do it, but it's not of great significance. And I think those words are not powerful enough, because I think they fail to express the deep desire of the followers of Christ to bring light into the darkness of our times. The desire for this light is not about new programs. It's not about pastoral plans. It's not about cunning ideas for renewal. God save us from those things. It's not about that. It is about the ancient and the new. It is about recognising that who we are and where we will go will be based on something in our history and in our lives is real. And so I believe a more accurate term is to regenerate. Regeneration. Now, regenerate comes from the Latin word regenerare, which means to bring forth, to recreate the light that has always been there. It's not a discovery of something we don't know. It's a light that's always been there. The word Genesis, linked, originates from the Greek, meaning origin, source, birth, or creation, to be born. Jesus describes himself as the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. There are many examples of darkness in our times across the world, and it's always been so. For there's nothing new under the sun. The saying, "It is better to light one candle than to curse the darkness," reminds us that cursing the darkness simply makes it darker. Simply makes it darker. And we're all really, really good at cursing the darkness, aren't we? You know? When you read something, when you listen to the news in the morning, you say, "I can't believe that. I can't believe that's happening. Did he really... Did the Prime Minister actually say that? Yeah? Did that MP..." etc, etc, etc. That's cursing the darkness. But St. John tells us that in him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness will never be overcome. Will never be overcome. Despite the hunger and the thirst in the human heart, and the fear of the darkness, and a world that seems to wallow in it, the light of Christ made present in Christ's body, which is the church, continues to shine in every age, despite the darkness. At the feeding of the 5,000, there comes a moment when the disciples can see it's late and that the people have got nothing to eat. To their surprise, when they say, "Lord, look, you know, let's send them away to get something to eat," to their surprise, Jesus says to them, "No, you give them something to eat. You do it." And what's their reaction? "We've only got 5 loaves and 2 fish. What is that among so many?" And very often when we think about evangelization, passing on the faith, whatever way we want to put it, that's our reaction. What have I got? I've only got this. There's only me. There's only a few of us. What is that among so many? What is that in terms of the need of our world today? What happens is, the small that they had, they offered to the Lord, and he blessed them. He blessed that which was so small, which they felt was inadequate, which they felt, you know, this is not going to do the job. Yet he blessed them, and everybody was fed. So much so that there was an abundance left over. An abundance left over. The moment and the awareness of the disciples that the people need food is key to understanding this story. And it's the reason, in one way, shape or form, we're here tonight. We see the hunger of the people of our time. And the Lord says to us, as he said to them long ago, "Go and give them something to eat. Go and give them something to eat." And our reaction will be, "What can I do? What have I got?" Well, nothing without God. Nothing without the blessing of the God on the gifts that he has already given us. Pope Francis would reflect, "If something should rightly disturb us and trouble our consciences, it is the fact that so many of our brothers and sisters are living without the strength, light and consolation born of friendship from Jesus Christ, without a community of faith to support them, without a meaning and a goal in life. More than by fear of going astray, my hope is that we will be moved by the fear of remaining shut up within structures that give us a false sense of security, within rules which make us harsh judgments, within habits which can make us feel very safe and comfortable. While at the door, people are starving, and Jesus does never tire of saying to us, 'Give them something to eat.'" Now, our immediate response might be, "Well, we'll do something new. Let's come up with a new idea." This is a common response. when we are presented with a problem. But before we start on the new, we must be aware of the present, and it is our failure to understand the present that is often the cause of our predicament. It is the time when Jesus says, you can tell it's going to rain tomorrow, you can read the weather. How is it you cannot read the signs of the times? It's a reprimand to all of us. Do we know what's happening outside of the door of the church? Do we know what's happening outside of our door? As the Guardian journalist suggested, the world is always looking for the new. But the church adds another word that truly enables us to navigate our way with something to say in every generation, giving light rather than just cursing the darkness. It took St. Augustine 33 years to discover the beauty, truth, and goodness that is God. The new evangelization, which is always ancient and new, unfolds the beauty of creation. Goodness shows us that in serving the men and women of our times, especially those in need, leads us to discover the truth of the gospel, which will always set us free. To just look at the ancient means that we are in danger of in living by values that are just old-fashioned, out of date. To just to look at the new means we face an uncertain future which lacks the wisdom of the past. It is the two that gives us the balance and gives us the unique insight in each generation to what's going on. Only to live by the ancient or the new is a half-truth. If you ever wondered what the word heresy means, it means half-truth. That's why it's so dangerous. Because it's like, you know, half of it is true. It looks good. And then it's the other bit's corrupted. That's why the church condemns heresies. Because it's not the full truth. It is only the full truth that sets us free, not half of it, or a corrupted part of it. The church, therefore, is the rock on which we may build. The gospel shows us the bigger picture. Inspired by the past and with faith and courage in the future, on this rock, the church may build a culture for today. Just as it has for 2,000 years, witnessing to Christ's message for all the people today. For Christ's redemptive work, while essentially concerned with the salvation of humanity, includes the renewal of the whole world order. That's reflecting what Maurice Glassman said. The renewal of the whole world. You renew the world in every age by raising up men and women, outstanding examples of your unchanging love. That's how the renewal of the world comes around. It's never through politics. Can't do it. Politics is just a way of dealing with issues. But the renewal, the regeneration, going back to that which is the very foundation. You are Peter, and on this rock, I'm going to build the church. That's why when we talk about the church, the best way to describe the church, as always, is the body of Christ, which is the church. It's a really important one, though, because that's what it is. That's what the church, people think the church is, the building next door. The church is the body of Christ, which is the church. So Jesus reminds his followers, when it's evening, you say it will be fair weather, sky, and in the morning it will be stormy. Therefore, let us interpret, understand the signs of the times. Now, before April last year, I think I'd have given a different talk. But things have changed. And it was a mixture of change because of this report that came out from the Bible Society, which you may have been aware of, called The Quiet Revival. And The Quiet Revival was looking at statistically at the change at what was happening in terms of church attendance. Now, 2018, the Bible Society had done a report then, And what it showed, essentially across the board, church attendance was falling off the cliff. Across the board. So they decided in 2024 to do another one, to see how it was going now after COVID. And to everyone's amazement, and they also got YouGov, which is the government statistical agency, to do it. And to their utter amazement, what they found was that there was this remarkable increase, particularly in the Catholic Church and in the Pentecostal Church. Now, the percentages were very different because the Pentecostal Church is actually quite small anyway, but as a percentage there, it was significant. But in terms of the Catholic side, it was truly remarkable. And it hit all the papers. It hit all the papers. And people were saying, well, you know, in fact, what was interesting was that the media coverage was really positive. It was as though they were saying, well, we're really glad that the church is not falling off the cliff. We don't want to lose it. We don't use it very much, but it's nice to have it there. No? And that's, again, that's part of that memory. It's part of who we are. I'm the president of the local British Legion in Silvertown. And we have a club, we're the last club in the East End. And my family just live up the road, so I can't often go in there and have a drink. And I was in there a while ago, and someone said to me, "If Father, what do you make of all these big processions through London? And they're all flying the Union flag." And he said, you know, and they've got crosses and all sorts of statues of Jesus and there. And what do you make of that? And before I could answer, for those of you who frequent pubs, you'll know that in a pub, right, there'll always be one old boy sitting there who never says a word. He's an absolute, one of the pillars of the pub. He just sits there with his pint, never says a word. Right? So before I could say anything, this old boy said, that's very easy to understand. That's very easy to understand. And well, there was silence. God, he's spoken. And I said, well, what is it? He said, it's the religion of the tribe. It's the religion of the tribe. They remember. Something tribal is something that's deeply inside you. It's deeply inside you. And in our culture, there is something deeply inside of us, which is part of our culture, is part of who we are. And many people come to this country because of that. And so there is that sense that within us, there is that longing for something that we can't quite. And in a time where everything seems to be going rather strange, to find something that doesn't change, that I can trust, that I can believe in, is something that will be part of who I am and has the ability to give vision and strength to build for the future. So when we look at what the church is asking us at this time to address this new evangelization, to actually to be able to speak to the people of our time about what has changed our lives, what has touched our lives, what's the reaction? Well, the first one is weariness. Weariness. We've done it before. We've done it before. It's another program from the bishop. It's another program from America. It's another program on this, that, and the other. And there's that sense of weariness about starting something all over again. In 1935, the philosopher Husserl, who inspired St. John Paul and St. Edith Stein, wrote that Europe's greatest danger is weariness. Let us do battle with this danger of dangers with the sort of courage that does not shrink even the endless battle. For from the ashes of the great weariness, the phoenix of a new inner life of the spirit will rise. I can tell you, Father Harvey is very surprised that I am quoting Husserl. Is that right, Father? So, before the essential and urgent question, what is to be done, we must raise the equally important question, what's actually happening? What is actually happening around us? And this is the story in which we find ourselves now and in which we all play our part. Modern thinking starts with, what do we do? We might respond to the question in two ways. Firstly, with a certain cynicism, and that's which says, oh, we've done it before. And that can lead to a deep weariness. The consequence of such weariness, if not addressed, is apathy, a cynicism, a sense of what's the point of doing it? Nothing can be done. We've tried that and it didn't work. We arrive at a dead end. The Roman historian Livy, in the year 56 BC, reflecting on the state of the Roman Empire, writes of such weariness, which can lead to the collapse of a society. He says, what happens is that society comes to a moment when it can endure neither its vices nor their cure. A society starts to die when it can't endure its vices, it can't endure what's wrong with it, and it doesn't know what to do about it. In many ways, that's a pretty good description of where we are today. But actually, it's a pretty good description of every moment in history when we are faced with these challenges. It's stuck, the energy's drained, and a profound weariness marks the institutions, and apathy paralyses the individual and the community. In his opening address to the Synod, Pope Francis reflected that there is a temptation of complacency, an attitude that says, we've always done it this way, and it's better not to change. That expression, we've always done it that way, is poison for the life of the church. Those who think this way, perhaps even without realising it, make the mistake of not taking seriously the times in which we live. The danger, in the end, is to apply old solutions to new problems. The second response is to look for a ready-made solution, a programme, a quick trip to the Catholic bookshop or online to find the latest resource. And while there are many resources available today, without an awareness of the signs of the times, we can spend money to no avail. So let's look at some of these signs. We are dealing with the first culture in history that was once deeply Christian, but by a slow and thorough process has been consciously ridding itself of its Christian basis. Let me say that again, because I think we can all identify, we can all see that. If we all had to stand up and tell a story of this, we'd be here till midnight, because we can see it. We are dealing with the first culture in history that was once deeply Christian, but by a slow and thorough process has been consciously ridding itself of its Christian basis. The great unease we witness within society today, which seems to deepen by the day, is the consequence of a great spiritual malaise in our world. The constant news of war, chaos, confusion, corruption and change recalls the words from Abide With Me, change and decay in all around I see. That's the experience of so many young people today. It's the change and decay which they see all around. But then, when we see the world through the eyes of change and decay, our hearts sink. There's a sense of being trapped in the bleak material view of the world. G.K. Chesterton would write, when people do not believe in something beyond the world, They will worship the world. And above all, they will worship the strongest thing in the world. When a man stops believing in God, it's not that they believe in nothing. When a man stops believing in God, they'll believe in anything. Watch the telly. Read the papers. Listen to the news. Look at what it is that people believe in today. Look. The late lamented Rabbi Jonathan Sacks wrote, "More than any previous generation in history, we have come to see the individual as the sole source of meaning. So it is worth reminding ourselves that there is such a thing as truth, a common good, a way of living, without which society disintegrates, falls apart. Communities are meant to integrate us. There are so many things in our society today that disintegrates us. It shows us the way to live together and the goods we share, the goods that only exist in virtue of being shared. The church's story is of God's unimmeasurable love for his people. In the face of humanity's choice to hide from God and to exchange the God who was their glory with the image of a bull that eats grass." Probably the most important question God ever asked, recorded in the scriptures. Have a think for a moment. What do you think it was? The most important question that God asked. It was this. "Adam, where are you? Where are you, Adam?" Now, he's not saying, "Adam, are you hiding behind that tree?" He says, "Adam, where are you? Where are you in your life at the moment? Because something's happened, Adam." And Adam says, "I hid because I was afraid. I hid because I was afraid." That's the story of humanity. We hide from God because we're afraid. That's our story. But the question is the most important thing. Because the question of God saying to us, to Adam, "Where are you?" tells us this most fundamental truth about our relationship with God is that God is looking for us before we are looking for him. God is looking for us. "Adam, where are you? John, where are you? Michael, where are you? Sheila, where are you?" "I was afraid. So I hid." And that carries on. He comes across Cain and he says, "Cain, where's your brother?" And Cain comes back with that really cheeky answer and he says, "Am I my brother's keeper?" And God says, "Yes, you are." Because that's the other part of the equation. That we can only receive love by caring and giving that love away to others. It's the fundamental part of being human. So we have those two fundamentals, those two basics there for us. But what happens is we substitute. So Moses goes up the mountain. When he comes down, they're having a great party. He's thinking, "Oh, they're celebrating me come down the mountain. Lovely." When he gets closer, he recognises they're not actually doing that. They'd made a golden calf. And he smashes the Ten Commandments. And there's that words in the psalm, "You exchange the God who is your glory for the image of a bull that eats grass." That's idolatry. It is the fundamental flaw in humanity. The worship of that which is not God. The worship of that which is not God. That's idolatry. And all the way through history, it calls out to us to make sure that that which we worship, that which we are inspired by, is God. Not some prophet, not some wonky dealer up the road, not the internet, not a president, not a king, none of those things. They have their place, but they only have their place in terms of the wisdom of the light of Christ. So To live solely by the worship of idols, the material things in life, how much, how long, how fast, how many, means we're living within a culture of limits. To live in a culture of limits means you live with something that can be measured. Now, if your culture is totally about things that can be measured, your life is limited. The material things. If it's about money, if it's about cars, if it's about treating people as items, if it's about all those things, always it will be limited. And the problem when it's limited, it's never enough. The material is always... Who are the most miserable people in the world? Billionaires. Because they can have everything they want and it's just not enough. So they have a bigger yacht. It's not enough. Because the material is always limited. But there's one thing that's unlimited. St. Bernard of Clairvaux, the great Cistercian, said, "The measure of love is to love without measure." That's the difference between the material things of this world, which are beautiful, but if we turn them into idols, we are worshipping that which is not God. And the spiritual, because it is the spiritual that brings the material to life. The measure of the spirit to live indeed is to live without measure. And so the hymn, "Abide with Me," continues, "O thou who changest not, abide with me. Change and decay and all around I see, but O thou who changest not," the one who doesn't change, the one who is ancient and new, does not change. So, are we living in extraordinary times? Weird times? Yeah, we are. But that's the story of humanity. No? Read a history book and you'll say, "Well, thank God I didn't live then." No? We live in each moment. This is the moment in which we live. So when we talk about extraordinary times, are we talking about the current challenges to world peace or the ongoing consequences of COVID? For the truth of the matter is that in the history of humanity, pandemics, plagues, wars, floods and famines are not extraordinary. You will hear of wars and rumours of wars, but to see to it that you are not alarmed. This is what St. Matthew. These things must happen, but the end is still to come. Nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There'll be famines and earthquakes in various places. At that time, many will fall away and will betray and hate one another. And many false prophets will arise and mislead many. Because of the multiplication of wickedness, the love of most will grow cold. But the one who perseveres to the end will be saved. Just a slight aside. You know, words are really important. And when we use words badly, or bad words are used in a nice, cuddly way now, it's a real fundamental problem. Right opposite me is St. Margaret's, there's a co-op. Right? And I go in there and I get the paper in the co-op every morning. And as I walk into the co-op, there's one of those display things. You know, they've got display things everywhere. And there's this one, it's about that big. It's full of toys. It's full of toys. And what are the toys called? Or what is the promotion? Wicked. 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 I don't know what it is. Apparently it's some film or something or other. And that's the children's toys. They're wicked toys. No wonder our kids are so confused. You know, we're all confused. God help the children. So, the extraordinary events of the world in which we live today are not defined by the frightening events that humanity from time to time faces, but by the severe weakening of the human genius inspired by faith that enables us to navigate our way through suffering and trial, guided by the truth that sets us free. Free to live despite the overwhelming events that surround us. Our crisis does not lie in the issues outlined by Jesus. It is the loss of faith in the God who enlightens us by his loving care and guidance, and the consequence of this loss on our day-to-day living, as we fail to embrace the truth that sets us free, leaving each generation to reinvent the wheel. It's a very lonely place if you have to reinvent the wheel. St. Paul says, finally, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is honourable, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think on these things. Whatever you have learned or received or heard from me or seen in me, put it into practice, and the God of peace will be with you. For the one who perseveres to the end will be saved. So many of our brothers and sisters, lacking the eyes of faith, do not think on the truth, the honourable, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, whatever is excellent or praiseworthy, because they have never been taught how to look upon these beautiful things. So, the danger of speaking at events such as today is that you might think, so is he going to tell us what to do? And the answer is no. 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 I have to work out where I am, and each one of us in our own way has to respond to this call to be the person that God has created us to be. There's that lovely quote from Newman where he says, to live is to change, to be perfect is to have changed often. Well, our immediate reaction is, well, oh, I'm not perfect. That's not what it means. You know, when we talk about perfect, we think, you know, that nothing goes wrong. That's not what Newman means. To live is to change, to be perfect. In other words, to be the person that God has created me to be. That's perfection. Not that we get it wrong. We never get it wrong. It is perfection, is becoming what God has created me to be. The unique person. So the second answer to the question is, what is the unique contribution of Catholicism to British society? I am. You are. Don't look elsewhere for it. You're part of the answer. Or we're part of the problem. And the choice is ours. In a speech to the Italian church in 2016, Pope Francis, in 13 words, gave a profound insight into the signs of our times when he said, we are not living in an era of change, but a change of era. We're not living in an era of change, but a change of era. Every culture that lasts understands that living within limits, limits set by natural law, cultural traditions, and ecological boundaries, is a cultural tradition and a traditional imperative. There seems to be only one culture in history that has held that none of this is true. And it happens to be the one we're living in. It happens to be the one we're living in. The wisdom of old age is wisdom because it's true, and men and women who have lived by that wisdom and the sufferings of humanity over the ages have come about by ignoring the truth that sets us free. In July last year, the Guild of Our Lady of Ransom organised a festival of Catholic life. First one we've had. And at Oscott College in Birmingham, where Father John and myself both studied, over 2,200 people turned up for it, much to our amazement. I think it's fair to say we were surprised by joy, as C.S. Lewis would put it. We started selling the tickets last month. Already 750 people have signed up for this one in July. This is part of our trying to recognise what it is that the church has to offer to our society. But before we do that, we have to understand it ourselves. You have to understand it ourselves. So the importance of what happens in our parishes, and what happens in the broader picture is of vital importance. And nothing is more important in building this picture than the parish. No new fancy idea from the other side of the Atlantic, no new this from anywhere, is a substitute for your parish and what you build in your parish and what you create. Because as people walk past the church, as they see your community, they will ask this question. They'll see something and they'll ask themselves, why are they like that? Why are they like that? Or they may ask, oh God, why are they like that? So which one is it? No? Because evangelization is not a program, it's a consequence. It's a consequence. It's a consequence that when you experience Christian life, when you experience the ancient and the new, when you experience the Eucharist, which is the source and summit of the Christian life, it raises a question in you. And that will always come from where you are located, your home, your community. Very often churches are the only community left. You know, when I was a boy in Canning Town, there was 56 pubs. 56. We're down to 5 now. You know? And the British Legion Club, 6. And all those natural places of coming together, they've largely disappeared. They've largely disappeared. Parish is still with us. It's that place where, in those moments where we need in our life what guidance, what light, when we're trying to pull ourselves out of the darkness and see something bigger than ourselves, that light is there. And our parishes, okay, you can get rid of any, all the other programs, whether it's, I won't name it, but it, you know, I think many of you know what program we tried, right? It's the parish. What do we do in the parish? How do we build the parish? What do we do to make the parish a beacon of the light in their local community? So what we do is something different. Right? Something different. Because it's ancient and new. In an article written by the Dominican friar, Father Thomas Joseph White, he says, so long as the church's message to the modern world is one of accompaniment in view of purely material ends, like looking after the sick, looking after the school, teaching, her services to the state will always be welcome. But they won't be essential. What is not essential is optional. And what is optional over time will fade to oblivion. Local authority likes to have the church there for us to do things, you know? By contrast, if there is truly a spiritual dimension in the human person, then not only is the spiritual adventure of human existence invested with transcendent purpose, lighted purpose, but also that purpose is to be found in the smallest details of temporal and civil life. So we come back to that original beginning. The renewal of society only happens by the renewal of the church. The capacity to name evil and seek the good requires a moral code. A culture that cannot name God ceases to be able to name evil for what it is and loses its capacity to name the ultimate good that can unite the aims of human beings one to another. Real progress is not measured by material technology, but by the advance towards the spiritual life. So no answers, but many questions. Recognizing our weakness, the little that we have, when we're called to feed the 5,000, we know that only with God's blessing will that little that we have become an abundance. And so at this moment in time, what do we do? We can look back and we can learn from the past, the ancient. That's the foundation. But this is our moment. This is our time. There's no point saying, well, this is what they did. Yeah, we know what they did in the past, and we learn from it. And the great theologian, Balthazar, it's another one who put a smile on your face, says this. In a glance, we perceive that all that has been realised so far is not what Christ now immediately demands of me, of you, of our generation. That history knows no solution for this moment, for the simple reason it's history and not the present moment. And since history does not know, we are free to look at the gospel in its simple solution, found in the presence of the Holy Spirit in our present age. This we call holiness. For holiness is the best proof that the church still has something, indeed everything, to say to the present and coming time, despite her age and the wisdom of old age. And so, to finish with the words of St. John Henry Newman in his second spring sermon. We thought we're faced with problems. Imagine coming back after the Reformation, having to rebuild the church, having to start again, having just that small remnant. Because remember, there was never a time from the moment of the Romans, when Alban was martyred, there's never been a time when there haven't been Catholics in this country. It was lovely when the king went to see the Pope. Everyone said, oh, 600 years. Oh, isn't that wonderful, you know? Isn't that wonderful? Yeah, fine. Go back 1700 years. That's where it started. That's the foundation. So Newman is there, and he's given this amazing thing called the Second Spring Sermon. A second spring. We are all products of the second spring. We went to Catholic schools, the parishes that we're in, they're all here because of the second spring. Parishes like this go back much earlier than the second spring because of the local rectors and family here at Ingerston Hall. We've always been there. We were persecuted, we were martyred, we were thrown out of the country, etc., etc. But the faith never went away. It's always been here, and it's here now. So now, it's not a second spring. Now, we're on the edge of a third spring. The third spring of the faith in our country. And the signs are very clear. The signs are very clear. So, to give us the strength that we need, I give you, finally, the words of St. John Henry Newman. According to our need, so shall be our strength. Our need is great, therefore our strength will be greater.